Welcome to the Move With Your Life podcast. Real stories, real heart, real people moving with their lives. Brought to you by Boundless Wellness Coaching. Hey everybody, and welcome back for part two of Get Psyched with Ethan Klukas. Ethan is a clinical research coordinator and psychometric rater at Okanagan Clinical Trials. He's involved in interviewing and screening potential patients, facilitating the patient's journey through study visits, and working with sponsors to ensure accurate collection of data. He's the primary coordinator of Clairvoyant Therapeutics' Phase 2 trial investigating psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy for the treatment of alcohol use disorder. Ethan works with Entheotech Bioscience as a research consultant and is passionate about the medicalization of psychedelics, as well as the influence of these substances on personal growth, spirituality, and society. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I highly recommend going back and having a listen to that before part two, but of course, join us here if you'd prefer to start now. Just a reminder that the views and opinions that Ethan discusses in this podcast are his own and not that of the companies that he works for. In no way is this medical advice, and each person should consult with a healthcare professional before pursuing any of these potential treatments. Without further ado, enjoy this conversation, part two, with Ethan Klukas.
Okay, we're back for part two. Part two! Ethan!
Let's go.
How pumped are you?
I'm very pumped.
Good.
Glad to be back.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us. So we started chatting a little bit last time. It was probably about a month ago about your work and especially around psilocybin, supporting therapeutic research, supporting clients as they're healing from alcohol use disorder, specifically. So we wanted to jump in a little bit more and talk about the experience itself. I've had a few questions from friends, family members around what it actually looks like to go into the setting, have the conversations that they need to have, and then actually get into the psychedelic experience. Right. So I guess I'm curious about starting out with what a typical maybe work day looks like for you. When you go in, you work with people, how do you actually have the conversation with a client to then put them through the process of intake and then get them into that experience of being in the setting where they'll have that therapeutic experience? Maybe let's start there.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So in the context of this specific study, we're generally at this point, we have people that are interested in doing the clinical trial. To get to that point, our site generally uses social media advertising. So we just run ads on Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, to get us in touch with people that are interested. Different sites do it different ways. I mean, if you're working at an institutional site, they might work directly with a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist might refer their own patients to the clinical trial if they think they're a fit, but that's not typically how our site works. So usually it's just an initial call with the patient. We run through a bunch of the different criteria for the study to see if they roughly fit who the study is looking for. We had talked a bunch about the parameters last time of a typical patient and who would be a good fit. So that could either be with myself or somebody else. And then usually a consent review is set up with the patient. So that's going through all the different aspects of what a clinical trial is, the risks and benefits, the fact that it's voluntary, that they can stop at any time, the fact that it's a free treatment. It's separate from Interior Health here in the Okanagan. So going through all that information and then going further a bit into the eligibility criteria. Obviously, there's a lot of things that we can't ask that might be based off of lab results or, an ECG readout. So anything we can ask, we do ask to make sure that they're a good fit. So that's a lot of the role, I would say, is just speaking with people. I think in the context of this trial, I've probably spoken to and done those initial brief interviews, not the full consent review, but the brief interview with about 1,200 people, which is a huge number of people. And I mean, we have help at the clinic in terms of people that are making those calls. Maybe 5% of those 1,200 actually get to the point where they're reviewing the consent form. And then even fewer actually get to the point where we bring them in for a first visit and go through all the assessments that we need to collect at the beginning. So that's a large part of the job, obviously running those first visits, setting those up, coordinating them between the lab team, the physicians, the therapists, and myself. That's another key duty of the job. And that's kind of going on in all the trials that we're doing. So that's maybe like you can think of the clinic as we're mostly clinical trials, but we also offer in the context of our Alzheimer's disease studies, we offer a memory clinic. So we actually do free cognitive assessments for the general community, just kind of as an outreach program. So we're able to have people come in for about an hour, do a brief clinical history, I guess, about different aspects of their cognition. And then we do a few different assessments. We're able to give them a readout on their scores relative to where they should be scoring or where would be roughly normal for them to be scoring. And then in terms of their memory, which is the part of their cognition that most people are coming in concerned about, there's different clinical trials for memory loss for different medications. So similar to how we're using psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy for alcohol use disorder, there's different trials for different indications like Alzheimer's disease. So it's a large part of the role as well, like outside of this particular trial we've been talking about is meeting with new and recurring patients in the memory clinic. And that's a really enjoyable part of the job. You get to meet a lot of new people and see how people's memories are doing and if it's wise maybe for them to consider some next steps. That's most of it. I mean, there's all the daily tasks that are probably a bit boring to discuss about just how a clinical trial operates and all the regulatory aspects, maintaining the pharmacy shipments, things like that, and then working with the study data. That's generally it's a fairly simple pipeline to getting to patients. I mean, they can be referred directly to the clinic. We've had people just walk into saying they're interested, and if I have time, I'll just chat with them right there. Usually about an hour, we can go through all the details and then make a decision about them coming in for that first visit.
Yeah. Awesome. So it sounds like you're not a team that when a person is with you, they're not a fit for any kind of trial with you. You're not just like, see ya, bye. You will help collaborate to find them the right sort of help
and
then work as a team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There aren't too many resources. I mean, for people that are coming to look for psilocybin assisted psychotherapy, this is basically the only place that you can do it in our city.
Right. Yeah.
Some people are able to get a Health Canada exemption, but that's exceedingly rare. Mm-hmm. And they might work with a clinic like Entheomed to do that, but those are under only certain circumstances right now. So that's just providing resources for general substance use. I mean, UBC Okanagan campus, they have a really good substance use clinic that has like a sliding scale for pay. So I think might be wrong, but it's between $10 and $80 a session with like a clinical psychology student. So they'll have like a master's in psychology, and usually their students working on their PhD. So you're not seeing a registered clinical psychologist, but you're seeing someone who's very qualified and has training in the area. And if you're, you know, on the lower end of the income scale, you could go have an hour session for $10 or $15. So I refer a lot of people there who are just having, you know, a challenge with substance use. There's all the traditional kind of services out there, which we make sure people are aware of in that process too, that this isn't the only option for them. It's an experimental treatment. AA exists, standard counseling exists. There's other treatments that they can pursue if they think that's a wise choice for them. So by no means do they have to use our services, but we're happy if they want to give it a shot.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. And some people it is their last option that they haven't tried. So if they're having a really resistant substance use disorder that they've tried AA and they've tried counseling and I've had some people, you know, I've spent $50,000-$60,000 on rehab centers over the course of my life and it's never worked and they're looking for something new, which is why it's exciting for people. I think though, I mean, if you're struggling with a substance use disorder, trying just standard counseling or psychological services is a good first step. You don't necessarily need to go to psychedelic assisted psychotherapy.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, if that's something you're interested in doing, it's not necessarily like a wrong step, but it's, it's kind of building on to the traditional therapy model. So if you have no exposure to that talk therapy model, it's probably a good place to start. But in the case where you've tried everything, I can see why people would be reaching out to us. And I mean, it's a new treatment modality in this area, and there really haven't been any new advancements in a long time. So
exciting place to go.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go into the space itself a little bit more. Last time you mentioned particularly around the comfort of the setting for people coming in for their first experience, there's some nerves, I'm sure, around that. How do you take into consideration the comfort of the space itself as a team, obviously, and then music that you might choose? Are there parameters around these things? I suppose I'm curious about how these inform, enhance, or alter the experience, if at all.
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so they definitely alter the experience. I think that's something, if people take anything away from this, is that the classic psychedelics, so psilocybin included in that, and LSD and DMT, we broke those down in the last episode. But the classic psychedelics, you can think of those as non-specific amplifiers of consciousness. So one metaphor that's been used is the reducing valve of consciousness. So in the state that you are and I are in, there's an endless amount of facts and stimulus out there in the world that we could be perceiving and then potentially acting on. And our nervous system is kind of the intermediary between all those facts and how we then act, so what we value. But we don't experience all that at once. I mean, right now I'm sitting in an office, I'm speaking with you, I can maybe hear my dog walking around, I can hear a car if I pay attention outside, I can feel the carpet on my feet, I can smell the coffee that's on my desk, but you're not taking that in all at once because we wouldn't be able to act in the world. So psychedelics in the traditional sense of a classic psychedelic, you can expect that the person's going to experience a lot more stimulus than they would normally experience. And so that's where the set and the setting are important. So we're going to talk about the setting, like the physical space. So a few things that psychedelic researchers have learned and that obviously make a difference in the actual experience itself is you want an aesthetically pleasing environment. So that's what we strive to have at our clinic. Something that doesn't feel clinical is very important. So you don't want it to feel necessarily like a hospital or like a dental office or something like this, where people are walking around with white coats on and you feel like you're going to get inspected. There was a study with DMT where they administered, I think it was healthy volunteers DMT, and it was in that type of setting. And there were several participants that actually reported that they had very realistic experiences of being medically examined by aliens. So they went into this altered state, and they're having a different experience with reality, and it ended up being absolutely terrifying for them. And they're essentially taking that in, and their brains are building upon, I guess, the environment that their body is in, but in a very terrifying way. So anything that's there and present can be dramatically amplified, but not in a predictable way. So that's why they're non-specific amplifiers of consciousness. So our setup is a very comfortable living room type setting, couch, chairs. We darken the room, which is partly helpful to direct the person to have an inward experience rather than, I mean, just being fascinated, I guess, maybe with the visuals they're seeing or looking outside or things like that. That's okay. But I guess in the purpose of a trial where we're trying to help people's mental health specifically, it's focused on that inward experience, and that's built right into the therapist's manual. Besides that, the room is fairly simple. I mean, the only clinical aspect is that we do have a blood pressure machine in there, and then just like an infrared temperature gun to monitor patient vitals during the experience. But then it's comfortable and quiet. It's away from the other clinical activities that we're doing. There's blankets. Usually the patients are lying down on the couch. Lots of them bring their own pillow, which is actually really interesting. I wasn't expecting that when we started the study, but everyone, I think it's more comfortable maybe than the pillows we have in the treatment room. But I think it's just something that provides extra comfort for somebody that maybe grounds them a little bit during the experience. Totally. So that's just my
safety. little bit of a safety blanket.
Yeah, it makes sense, familiar, right? Because they've been working with the therapist and they've been preparing for the experience, but really it's a short amount of time that they get to know them. It's five sessions, maybe of an hour each. So you have 5 hours, which maybe will be too little, maybe will be too much. You know, that might be adjusted as the treatments go along, but that's what we have in the context of this study. Mm-hmm. So having something else that I think can ground people, and they can bring in objects as well that might have personal significance to them.
Okay.
That of course are approved by us depending on what it is. Like, we don't want people on phones or iPads or things like that. They're going to distract from the experience. But
right.
One of the underground psychedelic therapists after kind of the prohibition of psychedelics, so he was working during the 1980s, he had people often look at photos of them as a child and the person's family as well, just personally mm-hmm. meaningful photos. I think it was before and then after the session as well. So people are welcome to do something like that as well, depending on what they're, you know, what they've been discussing with the therapist. Maybe if family's relevant, which it likely is with AUD. So that's the physical room itself. And then the music, I guess, is a whole other interesting conversation. There is a standard playlist that we use. So for the first session of the two, everybody's listening to a playlist from Johns Hopkins that they've used in some of their psychedelic studies. Mm-hmm. And then the second session, there's different options. I think there's about 4 or 5 playlists that the patient can choose from with the therapist. And in this study, most of the pieces, I would say it fluctuates, I guess, between classical music. There's different like music from genres or from around the world as well. And then more, I don't know how you would say it, but more abstract pieces almost suited to meditation. So you're not listening to pop songs or rock songs or something with a catchy hook or you know,
just stay in your head forever experience.
Yeah, I don't know. That'd be an interesting experience. I don't know if you'd get as much out of it. I think in my opinion, you want the music to bring that person to a peak experience in an altered state. And that's the theory of many of the original psychedelic researchers, is that was the point of the therapy in the actual psilocybin or LSD session, is bringing them to a peak experience. So having the music build almost in timing with the subjective effect of the substance. So if the effect of psilocybin, let's say, it peaks around about 2 hours after the person ingests it, the music preferably is building up to that point and then kind of staying at a peak level for the duration of that person actually peaking on the substance, and then tapering down in terms of intensity of the music as the person's tapering down from mm-hmm. the experience of the psychedelic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say this playlist that we use particularly does that. It's about 5.5 hours in this study. And I think that's going to be an interesting variable moving forward for them to actually have a look at and see how music specifically changes the experience, because I think it's obvious that it does. I mean, if a medical setting just visually is changing what somebody's experiencing, they're having a realistic experience of being medically examined by an extraterrestrial, I think the music that they're listening through another sense will dramatically alter things as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me that music would have that kind of impact on it, on us, on its own, right? There's so much research around that anyway, classical music for productivity, people looking at concerts and their euphoric effect on people who are attending the concerts, right? When we're all together in a setting and music builds like that, there's this almost communal euphoric experience that we're able to have together. So I suppose I'm curious about whether there'd be pushback on experiences being conjured by those types of elements. So like if someone's in a psychedelic experience and there's like a wave or a crescendo with the music and they're having some kind of meaningful encounter or experience within that treatment, would there be any kind of pushback from communities outside of your own and the work you're doing that might say that's a conjured experience or something that the person is like dreaming versus actually healing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with that. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe it's along the lines of someone could just say, well, it's just a drug experience.
Just like, a drug experience. Exactly. Relevant? Or EMDR. I remember that was a pushback with EMDR as well as a form of therapy that, you know, because the therapist is having them look at different directions or point their focus on different objects, the therapist is guiding them to something. And then the question from a client can sometimes be, did that actually happen or did I make that up? Right. Or is it a dream or was it an actual experience that I've had that I'm encountering? So I suppose I'm curious about how the community that you're a part of and the research you're doing counters some of those concerns when it comes to sure. the experience being manipulative.
Right. I think it could be characterized as manipulation. I mean, I think that has more of a negative connotation to it though.
Yeah, totally.
But we really are doing things in a very specific way to maximize the benefit, which
yeah.
I think you could maybe have the argument. I think the argument only works in this case because it's a psychedelic drug that has, I guess, a history around it. Because mm-hmm. in other, I guess, clinical trials that we do, that's exactly what they're doing as well, is that they're trying to develop a medication that has the maximum benefit to the patient. But in those situations, say you're developing a vaccine, there's not like a experience component to that. Like the patient doesn't get the vaccine and go into an exactly altered state right. and that somehow prevents
music on while you get your vaccine.
Yeah. Yeah. that doesn't somehow prevent them further from getting, you know, RSV or the flu or COVID or whatever it might be. Whereas in this case, the actual subjective experience is largely the point of course of the psilocybin session. And I would argue as well that maybe if some people think about it as a dream or just a drug state, I mean, it's personally experienced. So for me, I don't see how it's really relevant just because it's happening under the influence of a substance. I mean, many people come out of these experiences, you know, stating that they're the most meaningful or the top five, you know, most meaningful experiences of their life. So it's pretty hard to just discount those as a drug experience, absolutely. Especially when people are comparing those to like the death of a mother or father or the birth of a child being in the same category as that. So it's an interesting conversation. It goes down a rabbit hole of,
I know, we could have a whole other part three.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. Yeah.
But I mean, I had the same thoughts when I started getting into this area of research and practice, like is it cheating to do that, to use the music in this way? And how real is all this? And I mean, that's part of the reason why we're doing the studies. If it turns out that people that get placebo in those sessions healed at the same rate as people who got psilocybin, then yeah, maybe it's just a funky experience, but we'll see, I guess, kind of what happens here. But
and so far, it's not what's being shown, it sounds like. So far,
no, so far, it doesn't. Showing, yeah.
Yeah.
The data doesn't indicate that. I would love to see a study that instead of doing a comparison between a psychedelic and a placebo group, having people with the same condition, whatever it is, and you know, in two groups or three groups, and then just changing the music in the session. So, you know, half of people listen to this and then half of people listen to another genre, and that being the variable that's changing, because that's really the only way to find out what's going on with the music specifically. And you could have just a random playlist for one group that's kind of bringing people through all these peaks and valleys throughout the session.
Yeah.
And then the other group could have what I described, like a building effect of the playlist, the intensity, the style of music, bringing them to a peak experience, and then that dropping down as the person's kind of coming off of the substance. So I think that'd be really cool. I haven't seen anything like that so far.
Yeah.
So that would be a really cool study, because we haven't really seen a modality like this where music's so central to the experience itself. And it's almost like, I think I said this last time, it's almost like this is, it's talk therapy combined with a psychedelic substance combined with music therapy. So it's very, it's becoming more layered and complex, which I think makes sense in terms of healthcare generally. I mean, with more complex disorders like cancer, you don't just give somebody one treatment. There's layers of treatments that they'll go get, and it's kind of like a building on effect. So this seems similar. Instead of just talk therapy, there's also these psilocybin sessions, and there's also this fascinating music component that does something to speak to patients as well in a way that we really don't understand yet. I mean, we described the reducing valve of consciousness. And if psychedelics are just loosening that valve and letting in more information, those peak experiences, or I saw in the questions here, you had talked about mystical experiences. Those are available to people in regular states of consciousness as well. And encounters with quote unquote God or whatever the person might think that is. And just the fact that it takes a psychedelic to catalyze that process and put someone in touch with something that I argue always is existing in the space of consciousness. I don't think it could be discounted, I guess, that easily.
It's a brilliant answer. I think that's perfect. And I think it touches on that idea of mysticism during especially scientific experiences, right? So how do you think science and spirituality can coexist together? Do you think that's possible?
I think in the case of psychedelic therapy, it's necessary. That's one thing that motivates me to go to work today, is that we have, on one hand, this like beautifully understandable data collection process that's refined and rigid, and we know what we need to collect. But in working with the patients, it's messy. This sessions sometimes don't make sense or take a lot of cognitive power to process, I guess, with the therapist after, in terms of the patient's experience. And it's something I think that we haven't seen in science for quite some time, is this emphasis on spirituality or mystical type experiences and what those mean. And I think that part of the reason that people are so interested in this type of treatment is that it does acknowledge that, and that's been missing in people's lives and society for a long time. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to have rigid beliefs around spirituality or religion or anything like that, but
yeah, we're not even really talking about a being here. We're talking about an experience.
No, or even a set of, because there's a very specific, I mean, in the trial that we do at hour 7 post-dose, we give people what's called the mystical experience questionnaire. So it's a standardized set of 30 questions that we measure. And those look at 4 different factors. So transcendence of space and time, there's a mystical factor. So you could think of that as like mystery, awe, or fascination. Positive mood is the third factor. And then the fourth factor is ineffability. So something being ineffable is not being able to adequately be described in words. So those are the four factors. And we'll look at those, ask people these standardized questions. And a complete mystical experience is very reliably induced with a sufficiently large dose of psilocybin. So the numbers vary, but it's over 50%, given the correct conditions, or optimal conditions, maybe is a better way of putting it, that someone will have this full experience, like a sense of reverence, experience of timelessness, feelings of joy, feeling of pure being or pure awareness. And that's putting people back in touch with that, which obviously humanity has a very long history of spirituality, religion. That's a fundamental part that we develop just as beings. And I think it puts people back in touch with that in a way that's not religious. It's not rigid. It's maybe not what they grew up with or experienced around them, but it's in a pure form of experience itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly what's driving people to work in this area and research this area and also undergo those experiences themselves, because I think that's crucial to this whole healing thing that we're trying to do.
Totally. You know, we're not talking about a specific vein of anything here, just going back to your point about religion and spirituality. It's more so, I think, this idea of consciousness and understanding our consciousness in the context of community as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And those factors that I talked about on the mystical experience questionnaire, they're not rigid. They're not, yeah, I believe in this God that's defined by this. They're very, I mean, having a sense of reverence or that you're being in touch with the sacred, it's very open-ended. And people can connect with that. They might not want to describe that as God or a God in a certain religion, but they might describe that as something like ultimate reality or truth. And those concepts can be beneficial for people no matter who they are, what background they're from, or what their experience is. So I like that, how broad it is, because it's a nice way for people to interact with those concepts in a way that doesn't push anybody away.
Yeah.
And the therapists are able to work with people like that too. And as well as, I mean, there's pretty good evidence, or there's some evidence, let's say, that having a mystical experience during a psilocybin session is a predictor of the likelihood that that person will have positive effects after the experience. So it's what's called like a mediating variable. So it's explaining, well, psychedelics, let's say psilocybin, and people are healing. Like, how is that happening? What's the mechanism? So mystical experiences are one of the proposed mechanisms by which that relationship might exist. And there seems to be evidence for that with psilocybin specifically, whereas when you look at MDMA, people having a mystical experience during an MDMA session doesn't seem to be predictive of whether they have a benefit afterwards or not. So that possibly is not the mechanism by which MDMA is working, but it does seem for some reason likely with psilocybin. And so, for example, like positive mood during the actual psilocybin experience, and then how highly someone rates, I guess, like the mysticism aspect, those are associated with like positive persisting effects after the psilocybin experience. So people having more joy in life, expressing more love toward other people, feeling more connected with their community, which is really cool. So that's one thing that people fairly reliably experience with psilocybin, is this feeling of unity, either with consciousness or every being that's ever existed, or, you know, a feeling of unity with ultimate reality. And I think that's important because it gives people a window to connect with something that's larger than themselves. And in the context of maybe people struggling with, you know, let's say alcohol use, but comorbid anxiety, let's say. So this is really cool. Like, trait neuroticism, so your sensitivity to negative emotion and your likelihood to feel negative emotion, when that's rated like in a questionnaire, there's almost entire overlap with people feeling self-conscious. So the more you think about yourself and the more you're focused on yourself, the more likely that you're going to experience or at least be sensitive to negative emotion, which oftentimes makes people feel anxiety. And one of the remedies to that is to focus on other people or something else, or be in service to others. So in this psilocybin experience where maybe you're having somebody, they obviously are having an issue with alcohol, they're maybe anxious about that, and it creates this kind of feedback loop where they're constantly focused on their own alcohol consumption, getting anxious or upset that they're drinking, and then drinking more, and then getting anxious. And it's just this continual loop. The psilocybin experience radically changes that perspective, puts people in contact with consciousness itself. And then people after the sessions, there's this therapeutic window where they're able to consider that. And the therapists, I mean, their role is really to help people get the most out of those sessions. And it puts the focus less, I guess, on the person and maybe thinking about themselves. Paradoxically, they have to kind of go out into the world and interact with their community and their families and those things. And that seems to, I guess, like that's partly a remedy to anxiety disorders. So that connection with community, and it's so radical in the psychedelic experience. There's not really any denying it. It's not just, you know, maybe a few minutes, you know, in a social setting or something like that. It can be a radically changing experience. Yeah.
Wow. It's powerful. Like, this is powerful stuff when I think about the impact of it on an individual and then continuing on to trickle down into that community aspect, you know, reducing that isolation that somebody with alcohol use disorder might experience, and being able to allow them to open up to their family again and have conversations again and be able to tell them about what's going on for them. And that kind of relational aspect to it is quite powerful. And it really just reminds me that we can't heal on our own.
Right? No, that we need
others. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially with alcohol use disorder, there's so many far reaching consequences in the person's broader social community that need to be rectified in order for them to heal. They're not being themselves most likely and be okay psychologically.
Absolutely.
They've likely hurt people in their life that are close to them, and they most likely want a relationship with those people again, and alcohol has kind of been in the way of that.
Absolutely.
So, and there's something, I mean, back to the point about, well, it's just a drug experience. I think if someone can be in a deep connection, even if it's for a few hours with consciousness itself, or they can even experience it if they have particular religious beliefs in terms of whatever religion that they subscribe to. And that can be powerful for people as well. Like people,
absolutely,
you know, if they're Christian and people have had experiences of meeting, you know, God or Jesus, and you can see how that could be very powerful for that person after that experience and motivating in their day-to-day life.
Yeah.
So I think if it has that implication afterwards, I think we're all motivated to set up the conditions of the experience to be as impactful as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And out of curiosity, so when we think about that type of experience, if I were in that context where I'm encountering something or experiencing community and relationship or some being that is important to me, and I feel that euphoric sort of state or healing state, even though it might be a little bit terrifying as well at points, I'd imagine, if you're in that space, is it difficult for people to continue to live in regular time? Have you had any follow-ups with clients after the study to suggest that they might find it difficult not to remain in that state and to be able to go on with their regular life and day? I guess I'm curious about the potential for becoming addicted to these substances later because of that idea that they can remain in that euphoric state.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can talk about, I guess, abuse potential of the different substances separately. But first, I think partly your question is looking at it's a complicated, deep experience for people.
Yeah.
And I would say, yes, that is a risk, I guess, of taking a psychedelic, is that you get more than you bargained for. And part of considering these treatments is doing an inventory of yourself psychologically to see if you're ready to actually make changes in your life, if you're open to what the experiences has to offer. Because certainly, I mean, especially in cases where people are using a psychedelic outside of a clinical setting, like without a therapist or a guide or something like that, and they might be using it in a recreational setting, I think those are the preconditions that set people up for the most harm. And maybe not even just like, maybe not necessarily physical harm, but like psychological challenge. People certainly have, difficulty psychologically after these experiences, depending on what they experience, particularly if it's not a bad experience, but maybe more challenging experience than they expected to have. I mean, we talked about the mystical experience, and one of the key facets of that is positive mood, but not everybody, likely people, their mood will change rapidly from different emotional states to the next. But not everybody's going to have like a 6 hours of bliss in a psilocybin experience. A lot of people can experience like terrifying and horrible, I guess, either visual experiences or whatever they might be taking in through their senses. And so that's really crucial, is where the therapist, their ability to unpack that, consider if it's correct. And once this actually gets out into, you know, more mainstream clinics, that'll be up to the therapist or the physician to determine if this person's ready for another experience, if it's going to be helpful, or if it's kind of more beneficial to keep talking about it and continue doing talk therapy. So that'll be something I think has some flexibility. In our trial, we just do the psilocybin dosing sessions a month apart. So we haven't had the case where someone's not ready for that next one. I would say if you have a large psychedelic experience, doing it again a month later is very soon. Most kind of healthy people that are just doing it for personal growth or self-exploration, you can have a large experience with a psychedelic once a year, maybe, and that's going to be more than sufficient. And some people, they have, you know, you'll hear stories of people with, well, what's kind of the most meaningful experience you've had? And, oh, well, I used DMT. Well, when was that? 20 years ago. And they're still processing it because it was so beyond, I guess, what they thought was possible, that they're still processing aspects of that experience, and it's not really necessary for them to go back into that state. So that's part of, I guess, the risk of using a psychedelic, that you maybe get more than you bargained for when you weren't ready to experience that. And it depends too on people's personality and, I guess, their interest in philosophy. If you're not someone who regularly thinks about death or life or different philosophical things, or you're just kind of
you. No, I'm kidding.
you're going about your life, doing your routine and having an awesome life, and then you have this radical experience maybe with death and experiencing your own death in a psychedelic experience. Oh, wow. That can be a lot to throw onto a person if they don't have an actual support. That can be, I mean, damaging for the person moving forward. And definitely people, I think, that have used psychedelics recreationally in large doses frequently, you can very quickly get to a point where you're nihilistic and you're like, well, nothing really matters, because I've had these experiences and it shows that this normal state that we all live in is irrelevant. And you can go down a nihilistic rabbit hole very quickly, which obviously is not going to be healthy for someone to experience. And then you asked about the, I guess, abuse potential of the drugs themselves. So you can break that up into, I mean, when most people hear that, they're thinking about physical dependency. So using a substance, stopping use of that substance, going into withdrawal, having to use again to get rid of those symptoms. And then it creates a cycle of use, like we see with opioids, like heroin. Because it's extremely difficult to stop using. People tend to keep using, and that's kind of the state they're existing in. So classic psychedelics, so LSD, DMT, psilocybin, there isn't any sort of evidence or consensus that those cause physical dependence. So they're not thought of as typical addiction drugs that cause addiction, because they don't produce compulsive drug seeking behavior, like drugs like alcohol or heroin or methamphetamine do. And that's been confirmed as well, like in lab models of non-humans, so like mice, for example. They won't use a classic psychedelic to the point where they're overdosing and dying from the substance. Right. And I would say, given a sufficient dose and a sufficiently strong experience, people are not generally looking at using that psychedelic again anytime soon. So we've had patients come out after the session and say, there's no way I can do another session like that in a month. Like, that was so dense, so rich, so altering. I need time to process this and apply it. And sometimes people, they change their opinion. A few weeks go by and they're like, okay, I can actually manage. I can do this again. Like I want to do this treatment. This is what I originally signed up for. Of course, there's no pressure for them to continue and do another dose. But in that way, besides the physical dependency, if you're thinking about like a psychological addiction, I would say it's very neutral, if not like anti-addictive, in that they can be such shattering experiences that people aren't generally willing to endure that again anytime soon, or might consider a smaller dose if they've done a really large dose. And then outside of the classic psychedelics like MDMA, they do monitor that for its abuse potential in clinical trials, because there is more of a risk there. Obviously, that's like ecstasy is, you know, and has been used in raves and party and like party, I guess, culture over the decades. And so there's that whole like social component to it as well, and its use. There's a really fierce, or there, I don't know how fierce it is now, but there was a really fierce debate around the potential neurotoxicity of MDMA. And if it was neurotoxic, if it wasn't, there was groups doing research on, you know, kind of for and against and conflicting studies. There's a really good podcast by Andrew Huberman. He goes into MDMA.
Love Huberman.
Yeah. And that's really helpful. He I'm not going to say too much on it because he goes into so much detail around that.
He really does.
And I would say that they have done studies, you know, looking at people and looking at people's brains who have used MDMA in very high amounts throughout their lifetime. And there hasn't been anything that's been very conclusively showing that it has a neurotoxic effect. But after MDMA and classic psychedelics, we can talk about the abuse potential of ketamine. So obviously ketamine's been used in raves and nightclubs. In rare occasions, it can lead to overdose or death, especially when people are combining it with alcohol. So it's something important to consider. The substance never exists, I guess, in isolation. It exists in an environment and in a psychological context of the person using it. So those are what are known as extra pharmacological factors. So those are important to consider with substance use and with how people are using a substance. So obviously, polysubstance use can pose more of a harm than just using one substance alone. Large doses of ketamine can also potentially cause respiratory depression. So staff need to be trained in mitigation techniques for that. With patients, there is psychological and physical dependence noted with ketamine as well, partly because of its euphoric effect. So that's something that people can crave and want to experience again. And it's also used by some people as, I guess, like a social lubricant. So they're similar to alcohol. People get together and they're nervous. They have a few drinks to take the edge off. Ketamine can be used in the same manner. And people can kind of, I guess they can build up a tolerance to it and need larger doses to get the same effect and then continue using it in that manner. So there is some, I guess, potential for abuse or misuse of ketamine. But despite that, there has been research on ketamine to treat substance use disorders. So some clinics have steered away from treating patients with substance use disorders like alcohol use or opioid use with ketamine for the reasons that I just listed. But there's been multiple studies done in different substance use disorders. So for instance, there's been 6 done with alcohol use disorder, 5 done with opioid use disorder and ketamine, and then 3 done with ketamine-assisted psychotherapy for cocaine use disorder. Wow. And then other areas too, probably the largest effect that we see with ketamine is a moderate to large decrease in suicidal ideation for patients that are presenting with that, either in a clinical setting in a clinical setting where it's being administered. So yeah, that kind of sums up, I guess, the challenging experiences that people can have during a psychological or during a psilocybin or other psychedelic experience, and how they need to process those after, and then the actual physical and psychological dependency that can occur from each of those.
So I'm curious, because you shared with me a really interesting study about MDMA specifically for healing PTSD symptoms. And I'm curious about the crossover about this study in terms of your own work and where you see this potential for psychedelics going for healing complex PTSD.
Okay, great question. So we can talk about this new MDMA study for PTSD and then go in, I guess, into how it crosses over into other areas like psilocybin for alcohol use disorder. So the whole industry, I would say, has been waiting for this study. It's going to be of great benefit to all the other companies that are trying to develop psychedelic therapy models. So the first phase three that they did, this is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and they've been working on MDMA therapy for PTSD for about 20 years. So this is their final study that they'll likely produce in this area before they file with FDA. And then hopefully Health Canada and other jurisdictions to actually bring the treatment to patients. So they did their first phase three and published it in 2021. And then this is their second phase three, which is often required that a regulatory body will want two larger phase three studies before they approve a treatment. So yeah, this one looking at patients with moderate to severe PTSD, I think most around 75% of people or 73% of people actually had severe PTSD, which is really cool. They're not shying away from that, probably the toughest group of people with the disorder to treat. They're not just looking at people with mild PTSD or in, even into moderate. They're really three quarters of the patients that they're treating have severe PTSD. I think with a mean duration of about 16 years. So these are people that have been struggling with PTSD for a long period of time who have likely tried many different treatments. They go through all those in the different descriptive statistics in the actual paper. But this one's using, I believe, three sessions of MDMA combined with talk therapy. So very similar to the psilocybin trial that I'm working on. We're only doing two sessions. I think this one used three in total. They also had a very ethno-racially diverse sample, which is great that they use this. So much research in medicine and psychology are white, rich samples of patients. So they're have a high socioeconomic status and they're of European descent, which is really hard to generalize to other populations. So MAPS for this study really put in the effort to actually get a diverse sample so that they can generalize the results to a larger amount of people. So yeah, the setup's very similar. MDMA is going to have a different mechanism, different duration than psilocybin, but the sessions themselves are very similar. They're trying to be comfortable for the patients. They're doing preparatory therapy before the first MDMA session starts, and then kind of integrative work and continuing talk therapy during the actual trial. And this one really had stunning results. So I think 52, so roughly half of the patients in the trial got MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. It was about 86% of them actually had a clinically significant drop in symptoms. So they obviously look at that diagnosis at the start of the study, and then they redo the diagnosis according to the DSM at the end of the study. And I think they defined it as a drop by 10 points in the CAPS, which is the actual assessment itself for to diagnose PTSD. So they said anybody who's had a drop of 10 points, we're going to say that's like a meaningful benefit to the patient. So it was 86% of those actually had that benefit, and then 71% roughly no longer met the criteria for PTSD at the end of the study.
Wow.
So that's really groundbreaking, going from severe PTSD and then to 71% of those people, you know, they have the end of the study, they do the assessment, and the physician says you no longer meet the criteria for PTSD at all.
Incredible.
So I think that's even better than we're all expecting. Even if it was a quarter of people, I think we'd be excited, because obviously a very challenging disorder to treat. And for people that have on average been struggling with that for 15, 16 years, they've likely tried many other treatments to no avail. So having 71% is great. Really positive. I mean, now probably for the rest of the year, they're going to work on actually getting in all the data to the FDA. And I think if we saw maybe a poor result with this study, the whole industry would have been affected, possibly investors pulling out of psilocybin trials, LSD trials, DMT trials.
Imagine.
We've actually seen, yeah, like a big kind of increase in terms of, you know, the hope that those companies will actually make it across the finish line and develop treatments. So MAPS is really leading the way, and all these other companies are kind of on their coattails riding the wave, because most of the companies they're not, you know, they have no revenue because they don't have any treatments approved. They're all in the clinical development stage. They're relying on investor funds to kind of remain as businesses, and many companies have ceased to exist in the last few years for those reasons, just because we haven't had those results. So this could be the first, I guess, psychedelic, if you want to call it that, treatment that could be approved. And obviously there's a huge amount of people that could benefit, benefit from this. I mean, a lot of credit to MAPS for persisting this long, and they're not a public company either. They basically just rely on donations and investors donating the money to do these trials, which can cost up to $100 million to do one of these studies correctly. So I think they'll be at a crossroads now to see what they want to do. They might become a public company, you know, like that you can buy shares in and will be trading on the stock market. But I think their goal is to stay a public benefit corporation and pursue a totally different business model than Big Pharma. Big Pharma does. So yeah, overall really positive like results. I'd encourage people to go look at the actual paper. It's just available on Nature. I think it's Nature Medicine it's published on, and it's free access. So lots of these journal articles, people have to pay or have a subscription to a university or something like that. But this one, they've paid for it to be available to anybody that just wants to Google it and download the actual article. And once again, in terms of like actual effect, obviously a lot of people aren't meeting that criteria for the diagnosis at the end of the study. But in terms of the actual statistical analysis, the effect sizes are really huge. So the actual, you know, it spits out a number that shows you like what the difference is between the groups. And the placebo group, they also improve. It's not like they don't improve at all, but just relative, adding the MDMA goes above and beyond the improvements of just the talk therapy, which some people like to argue and say, well, look, you could just help people with therapy as well. That is the case. Most people don't have access to high quality therapy, but I think those placebo results actually speak to the benefit of the things that we've spoken about with the setting of the experience, the relationship with the therapist. All those things are necessary preconditions for MDMA to actually have the effect that it does. All those have to be in place. There has to be this safe, trusting therapeutic container, the right environment, the right setting, because with those, people get better already, just giving them a placebo, and then adding MDMA in the case of this study goes way above and beyond that. So that's really exciting.
So how does that cross over? Because you mentioned MDMA being a synthetic, which, yes, absolutely. How does that cross over into your work with psilocybin? How do you think this study impacts your own work? Or does it?
I mean, I think it indirectly keeps us going, because obviously we're working for a different company. We're not working for MAPS with MDMA, but we're in the same sector. That's
right.
And now there's been even more momentum, especially if this gets approved. I think we'll see a lot more investment into the area, which helps these projects continue on. And when you're working on these studies, you never know if they're going to either could shut down any day, depending on what the company is thinking and what their investors are wanting. I mean, we've had trials where investors have just pulled out their funds and the trial ceases to exist and all the patients have to be discontinued. And that's the end of that. I mean, I don't know. It's so different, PTSD in lots of ways, from alcohol use disorder and MDMA from psilocybin. But a similarity is that it's a very purposeful process that you're going through with the patient. Mm-hmm. And the goal is legitimate healing that takes time and patience. Mm-hmm. So these aren't a quick fix. But it's showing that, you know, you can fine tune and nuance the treatments maybe between MDMA and psilocybin, but there is a really beneficial way to do it. And it took 20 years for MAPS to actually put this together and find out like what sort of training do the therapists need? What sort of setting do we need to do this in? How many doses, how far apart are the doses, and what are the meaningful things to actually keep track of after the experience so that we can prove that it actually helps people. It shows that it's possible. So I think that's encouraging to us working on psilocybin research. Maybe Absolutely. The study that we do, it's an earlier phase than these studies. It's not even in phase 3 yet. But it kind of shows some hope and kind of proves that there is an optimal way to do this that can benefit a lot of people. And even though it's a different substance, maybe in a different protocol, it's still going at that transformative, it's seeking a transformative experience with the patient that's going to have the most beneficial lasting change. And that's what we're trying to do with psilocybin.
Hmm. We covered a lot of ground today. So we've talked about setting as usual. This is my style. We talk about setting. We talked about spirituality. We talked about the benefits of the studies that you're doing. We talked about some of the risks as well. I guess I'm curious to take yourself out of the scientific lens for just a moment and kind of speak to our listeners about why this work is important. If you had to leave them with sort of one thought about what is the most important thing for them to understand about this work, what would you say?
I think we're in the same way that our normal state of consciousness is so restricted. I think we have a restricted society as well in terms of what's possible. And these treatments allow you to dream a lot bigger. And also be okay with complexity, nuance, and just the mess of life and navigating life. And I think that's missing from our society generally. There's not a lot of nuanced conversations happening, and normally with, you know, big questions we might be asking, the devil's always in the details. And certainly in these studies, the details do matter. The small things matter, and it's kind of the amalgamation of all those small details that can really result in a transformative experience for a real human. So I think I see this work as, yes, it's work, and it's in the very specific context of healthcare, but the way that we think about it, the openness that we have toward the ideas and being open to new ideas and being wrong potentially, but also the rigor in which we conduct the actual trial and the excellence that we pursue, I try to use that in my own personal life as well. It's kind of like it seems maybe like a contradictory approach. It's being comfortable with things that are seemingly opposites, like this really rigid data collection process and reporting to Health Canada, we need this, but then also just having this very open mindset and allowing yourself to potentially realize that nothing you really know is correct and there's something else out there to pursue. And I think that's missing, I think, certainly from many conversations in society, especially around politics and so things like that. And we could probably learn a lot from that and apply it in that. Hopefully that's a great answer. I mean,
it's a great answer.
Again, very long-winded.
No, it's perfect. It's it goes along with that discussion we have often in this podcast as well about that sort of ability to hold two truths at once. There can be mystery in life and conversation and ambiguity, and it all belongs in the same space.
Right. Yeah. And that's what you learn during these experiences. And it's not just relevant within being treated. Everybody can learn from that, which is what we talked about last time. I mean, ultimately, many psychedelic researchers are not only interested in treating mental illness, I'm interested in how this can just help a normal person reinvent themselves to live a better life. Yeah. And I think it does have that power. And that's what our society and people, individuals urgently need to cope with an increasingly complex world where we do have to find a way to manage paradoxes in our life and integrate things that seem to be opposites or both can't be true at the same time together. Yeah. I think these experiences can help people hopefully make a small step toward managing that.
I love that answer. Thank you so much for joining us for part two, Ethan. Really appreciate it. And who knows, maybe we'll have a part 3, 4, 5, because there's like a million things to talk about here. Someday, when you don't want to throw a shoe at your computer because our Wi-Fi issues are so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll figure it out eventually.
All right. Thank you so much.